listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Welcome, everyone, to the Tennis.com podcast. This is a year in preview edition. I'm Ed McGrogan here with Steve Tigner, no stranger to the weeks in preview, but this time we're going to go over the entire men's season in a way for 2015. We're going to take a crack at who we think will end up in the top 10 this time next year as we approach the new season coming up very quickly on us. Steve, this was a year where the top 10, as it finished, there was some, I think there were certainly some players who obviously made some significant moves from years past, but, you know, on the whole, it's still very top heavy. But after that, there was a lot more change than usual. And I think we, you know, the takeaway from that is it should be a pretty interesting year to see what the next chapter is in the men's game.
Yeah, we saw a little change, you know, sort of gradual. Some of the guys we've been watching, like Raonic and Dimitrov and Nishikori, they all made some moves, but not, you didn't get the feeling that they made their, you know, the big move. None of them, I don't think, is topped out. So like you said, yeah, this should be another year of progression, I would think, to something different.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing is if these players are really just kind of getting their footing on this terrain here, that's very interesting stuff. I mean, the top 10 as it ended, you know, 10 is Ferrer, then Cilic, Raonic, Berdych, Murray, Nishikori, Stan, Rafa, Roger, and Djokovic at the top there. So, and Dimitrov right outside the cusp at number 11 there. I think we should probably just get right into it in a sense with that said here. Number 10, as I mentioned, that's where David Ferrer is hanging out here. I think so many people might expect, you know, the inevitable downturn of such a strong player from a physical point of view. It does seem like it's finally, the toll is finally being paid by him, and I'm not sure I would predict that he hangs around in this list for another year. I mean, he surprised us many times before, but who do you have at number 10 at the moment?
Number 10, I have a surprise pick, Gael Monfils, moving from 18 to 10.
That is a bit of a surprise there, but ended the year very nicely.
Pick, but I do think he showed something in the second half of the year, not just in his, you know, we always knew he could play and he showed that, but I feel like he showed a little more confidence in himself in that loss to Federer at the US Open and then coming back to beat Federer, who was hurt, but I feel like that coming that close at the Open, in the quarters of the Open, if he wins that match, there's a good chance he can get to the final of the tournament. That I feel like was a breakthrough for him, and I just felt like it's possible that he could begin to take himself more seriously next year, and if he does that, then you know he can do whatever he wants.
He obviously has the physical element to back that up. Yeah, I think as you've written before, I think it was a more of a philosophical Gael at the Open, despite the loss there, and you know, watching the Davis Cup final at the end. I mean, He caught Federer on a day when Federer hadn't recuperated clearly all the way, but that match was really about Monfils as well, and I think that Switzerland probably would be dreading playing a fifth, even with Wawrinka, you know, facing someone like Monfils in that situation. So I think the end of the year for Monfils was, as you say, suggests a very big turning point.
Yeah, it's more of a wishful pick, hoping that he does a little more. You know, he's in his late 20s, but I do think it's possible.
All the French players really have taken their turns in a sense of, you know, kind of asserting themselves among the men here. And I think, you know, Monfils, he's had semifinals at slams before, but you know, perhaps this really is his, time here. Another player I didn't mention, Song, at number 12, also turning 30. It's almost surprising to see some of these guys now in their very late 20s and 30s here. So We'll see where Mr. Monfils ends up when all is said and done here. Number nine right now is Marin Cilic. This bottom of this top 10 is very fluid in terms of the points, too. Going into next year, a lot of this is going to shift around pretty quickly because this, if you remember, you know, how tight the race was for the spots at the World Tour Finals, it's because the point totals were so close here. So Cilic is at number nine, obviously, thanks a lot to that U.S. Open title. Who do you have at number nine?
Number nine, coming into next year, I have Dimitrov. I think he has I don't know whether he ever has top five in him, but I think he has more than what he showed at the end of last year. Like he made another step forward. He cracked the top 10 for the first time last year, but he didn't really end the year all that well. He showed a lot of flashes as he usually does, but I feel like there's another step forward or two for him. He's still only going to be 24 this year. But I don't see him jumping further than into the bottom of the top 10 at the end of the year. You know, he's another guy you'd like to see do well, but I'm just not sure if he has the kind of game that's just going to continue to rise up. I feel like a lot of these guys at the top are bigger hitters, and this is sort of as far as I can see him going at the moment. You know, we'll see.
He's also going to, I think, be dealing this year in particular with a lot of added pressure and expectation from a lot of us, a lot of, you know, fellow players. I think the word is clearly out on what Dimitrov is capable of and what he did last year. So I think that's also something that we'll have to see how he handles that. He's going to be seated pretty high at a slam, and that's sort of a double-edged thing there. The spotlight is going to be on him, for many reasons, but you know, first and foremost, it's going to be because, you know, he's almost in the top 10 now, and obviously, I think we think he's capable of, you know, perhaps much more there too.
I also wonder about his relationship with Roger Rashid. It's been a good one, and Rashid has been a good coach for a lot of guys: Hewitt, Monfils, and Tsonga, Dimitrov. They've all benefited with him. He's very intense, physical, you know, more of a trainer than a tennis coach, but I also feel like he can burn out with guys. You know, I feel like there's a limit to the amount of time that guys can go with him. And I wonder whether Dimitrov, they've been together for a year. I'd wonder how much longer, you know, their relationship will be productive. So that's something else to think about.
It's like the John Tortorella of tennis coaches, I think is how you put that there. You know, that's actually a good point you make about coaches in general, is that I think, you know, going even to the top levels of the game and in the past, I mean, tennis players just don't stick around with a coach for certain, you know, for an entire career, and it's usually multiple coaches helping players along the way. Is there something that just, you know, as you've followed the sport for so long, that coaching player dynamic, it does seem very unique to tennis, especially when you compare it to, you know, other sports perhaps. And I know this is an individual sport, of course, compared to team games, but in this time of year too, we're seeing so many coaching shifts yet again here.
I think it's a lot. You know, the relationship entails a lot. It's a lot more than a team sport where, you know, if you play basketball or soccer, you'll see your coach, you know, at the stadium, and that's probably it. But in tennis, you're traveling with your coach, you're doing dinner with your coach, you know, you know, pretty much everything is scheduled by your coach. And I think that has its limit as to, you know, A, probably people get sick of each other, and B, how, you know, the sort of the how much somebody can help somebody. I think maybe there's a time limit on that, where you get as much as you can out of a certain guy or a certain woman, and then you have to, you know, you need a new voice. So I think it can happen pretty fast with tennis. It's a very intense relationship. I mean, if those guys, the players, are with their coach more than anybody else, so, you know, I think it's rare where that can really work out for, you know, for a long time.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, especially with so many high profile former champion coaches, especially on the men's side here, where that goes. you know, basically the year after. And, you know, even with Yvonne Lendl and Andy Murray, who obviously did so well together, even that didn't, you know, is already over with. It seems like it just started, too. So that's a good old, I think, sub-theme for...
That's one question I have about the super coaches. How long do they want to do this be full-time? You know, Lendl obviously had his, you know, wasn't really prepared, doesn't need to be on the tour all the time. Will Edberg and Becker, how long are they going to stick around when they really don't need the money, when it's sort of just something they did because they were asked to? So, you know, we'll see how permanent those things are.
Right. Yeah. So let's move on to number 8, and this is currently occupied by Milos Raonic. Nice little surge from him this past year. I mean, he's been very, I think, deceptively consistent for a little while. Ends up at number 8. Who do you have at number 8 going in 2015?
This 2015, I have Thomas Berdych hanging around. He's maybe coming down a little bit. I felt like in the middle of last year he had a slump, and he's in his late 20s like a lot of other guys, and I wonder whether that was the beginning of sort of his demise. But he came out of it all right. He also has a new coach. He tried to get Lendl, tried to get his super coach, but he ended up with Lendl's old assistant and Murray's old coach, Danny Valverdeau. So that, I think, is a positive for Berdych that I think will help him this year, or maybe just this year alone. I feel like he'll get a boost from a new voice, from a new coach. He's a guy who hasn't really changed or done a lot in that, you know, in that part of his game, hasn't gotten a lot of different voices. So I think that's a help, and I think that will keep him around in the top 10, but I don't see him, you know, I don't see him being ranked higher than he was last year.
It's funny, we're going to go into coaches a little bit again here, but I think both of these two really have a lot to prove, actually, and really are going to, I think this opportunity for Valverdeau, as you mentioned, I never totally got the sense of where he... Yeah, he was spoken very, very highly of it with Murray. I think he was often cited as a hitting partner, but he was really clearly a coach as well, and you know, worked with Lendl during his time there. Those two have known each other for forever, and it's a pretty big gig for him, I think, getting a player like Berdych, who, as we know, still hasn't won a slam. I don't know how you can say that he doesn't have the game to win the slam, but it's really more, I think, between the years with him a lot of the time. It's watching him, it almost never ceases to amaze me how hard he can hit the ball with what looks like such a pretty compact swing. And the guy does things that even though we've seen it a million times, and even though he still gets beat by the top guys a lot of times, he really, in his own way, is quite a pleasure to watch when he's on.
Yeah, he really is pretty extremely smooth. And I think you're right that these guys have something. You know, I think Berdych has – this is really maybe his last run to show people. And I think, you know, Valverdeau as well. Like, he is a guy who's always been in the shadow of another coach. He's really you would almost make him the equivalent of, like, Severin Luthi with Federer or Marion Vida with Djokovic. He's a guy – who really was the sort of core coach of Murray. Lendl was more, you know, he played a sort of supervisor role, I think. But we'll see what he can do on his own. And I think we'll see. But I could see it being a good match and them getting, you know, having a productive early part of the year.
All right. Well, we're on to number 7. This is this was Berdych's spot. We just obviously just went through him. We have a couple players I've noticed that have come up from outside the top 10 already that have made their way into your 2015 top 10. There will be some names stepping out of the current top 10. So let's see your number 7 year-end player on the men's tour for 2015.
7, I have Raonic, who you just mentioned, who finished 8th last year. I see him making some, you know, a little more progress. You know, I definitely, but I also see limits to him. I think he had a very steady season. He won tournaments. He made quarterfinals at Grand Slams. He made the final 8. You know, he showed he can beat pretty much anyone. He beat Federer. But he also just seems to me, I'm not sure whether, as with Dimitrov, I just don't know about him how far he's going to move up, you know, ever. I think his serve keeps him at a certain place. Then the rest of the game also keeps him from going further. So we'll see. I just see a little more improvement for him. He's also going to be 24. This is entering his prime. You know, he could come out and win Wimbledon or win a Grand Slam, the U.S. Open. That's not out of the question. No, nothing's really out of the question with him with that serve. But over the course of the year, I see him, you know, just being a little better than last year.
Yeah, like I said, I think deceptively consistent is the way I would describe him. It's funny that you mentioned with Dimitrov and that, you know, you were wondering, you know, whether Dimitrov's lack of that game-changing weapon can get him above where you have him slotted. And, you know, with Raonic, obviously there is that clear game-changing weapon. Overall, I think the more I've watched Raonic, I don't think it's the greatest. I don't think it's the most enjoyable tennis to watch sometimes, but I do have to give him a lot of credit along the ground. It's just, he's not going to be. You can't say that when he gets engaged into a rally, even with a fantastic rally, or that it's automatic point over for him, and he has to win the point after the first two or three balls. I mean, the big guys that have relied on their serves, obviously, that have made their way to this point of, or to this echelon of the game, they've really proven, you know, why they're there, and that's that they can demonstrate more in the serve. But, you know, once you get to this top five here, I mean, the differences between the getting to that point and getting, you know, to where we're talking about now, you know, they're very big differences in what players have to do, and you have to make some judgment calls somewhere. And I think that's, you know, what we're seeing with Raonic here.
Right.
Yeah. So let's move on up to number six. Are we at
number six? Yeah.
Yeah. This is Mr. Murray. Now we'll see where he ends up on this list, if at all. I suppose there's a chance, but we'll see where Murray goes. I think his 2015 will be one that's closely followed for a lot of reasons. Who do you have at number six?
I actually have Murray staying there. I feel like a couple guys passed him or showed that they can pass him last year. Wawrinka and Nishikori in particular, and even Federer, I think, sort of reasserted himself above Murray for the moment. Murray had a good end to the year. Federer, of course, beat him badly at the last tournament. But I feel like Murray, I just don't know whether we're going to see him get back to where he was.
Do you think he's sort of peaked already?
I feel like maybe he has. With the Wimbledon win, he got, you know, up to number two. He had back surgery. It's taken him a while to get back from that. I think he is back from it, but I don't feel like he's going to be challenged for number one the way we would have thought after 2013. I sort of see him below a few guys that have come up. Not really.
I don't think it's really a slight on his game. Yeah, perhaps you're trying to say. Yeah.
As much as Murray getting worse, but I think there's some limits to his game as far as the power goes. And some of the guys are, you know, maybe Wawrinka and Nishikori are bigger shot makers. And I think Federer has at least another year where he's going to be. I feel like he's going to be as good or better than Murray. So I sort of see him staying where he is, having good matches, some frustrations. I don't know whether the Maresmo coaching thing, I think that's fine. It'll be interesting to see how he does without two of his other members of his team that left, including Valverde. But I don't see that changing, making things a lot better or a lot worse for him.
I guess, you know, Murray, I think you can draw a lot of comparisons to him, excuse me, and Djokovic in a couple ways. You know, they have the age, they're both the same. They're both obviously these baseline greats. But, you know, you can clearly, and I think both, it should also be said, really just, they're very emotional players, and that's a big part of their game, and it's a big reason why I think they are the way they are. But at the same time, you know, you can clearly see the difference between why Novak Djokovic has won seven Grand Slam titles and why he is a clear world number one right now. and why Murray is where he is as well. And I think really the struggle that it's taken him to have won that first Grand Slam title after so many final round shortcomings, and obviously why Wimbledon was such a big deal for him. You know, for Murray, I think that's an interesting way to see where he is. And I think, as you mentioned about Stan and Nishikori like that, I still think there's potential for Murray, at least from my end, to kind of make it back into that top four. I think a lot of people are really sort of wondering if they want to keep Murray in that, obviously, that self-proclaimed big four group there. You know, Stan and Nishikori, excuse me, they still really do have to kind of prove on a year-to-year basis that they can keep up with this. And to Murray's credit, this is the one thing that I think I will always kind of have to remind myself of him, is that he has been doing this and winning big titles and big tournaments since about 2008. And it's something that we probably just, you know, should always kind of keep in the back of our mind when regards to Murray. But you know, injuries aren't helping him either, and he has, you know, showed a little susceptibility to that as well.
Yeah, he's in the second half of his career. But I thought last year and over since his Wimbledon win, he's sort of gone from challenging for the biggest tournaments, and then this year he ended up winning a few small tournaments at the end. It just seemed like, in general, there was just a slightly lowered expectations for him from the very top to where he was having success, as the best of the second tier. So, you know, we'll see if that continues. But I felt like that was the trend of the last year and a half for him.
Yeah, and that loss to Federer it's still hard to believe that happened. I mean, that would never. You almost think that would never happen to Murray a couple of years ago. Right. So we'll see there. Number five, this is currently where K. Nishikori resides. Your thoughts on number five in 2015?
Number five, I have Stan Wawrinka at five. Pretty much the same. I think he ended the year well, which I think is good. With his win in Davis Cup, and he had a good World Tour final, and he had a good World Tour final the year before, and he came out and won the Australian Open. I also think I don't see Stan moving up further than where he is, because I feel like last year he showed what he can do, and that he will beat top players and win big tournaments, but also that he's not really a different player than he was. You know, he didn't suddenly become Novak Djokovic. He didn't suddenly become a guy who's going to be consistently, you know, challenging for these top tournaments. He was a guy who hadn't won many titles at all over the course of his career, no big titles, and that's sort of the way he went the rest of the year. He was pretty erratic, pretty up and down, some amazing wins, and then some amazing losses.
I think maybe you say that Stan, you know, hit his peak last year, but that peak is so high that it's capable of beating anybody on this list. I mean, it's capable of beating Djokovic. He did that before at the Australian Open, among other players. He beat Federer for his Monte Carlo Masters title. He's, the top of his game when it's white hot has proven to be just, you know, quite a feat of tennis, and right. I think that's what we can perhaps see. You know, it'll be interesting to see what he does in Australia too with that title defense coming up. I think that's going to be a pretty big, I think, internal target for him to really kind of, you know, love to back that up. Of course, had a great end of the year, so I think Australia is pretty telling for him among other players.
That's the big one. If he goes out early there, you know, his ranking plummets. That's true. That's a big term. That'll really set, I think, will set a tone for him for the year. And he, you know, his ranking could really change there, and that in a bad way. And that, you know, that wouldn't be a good way to start the year.
Yes. Yeah. So number four, I'm curious to see who you have here, because I think it'll tell a lot about the rest of the list here. This is where Stan is right now. So you're number four for 2015.
Four, I have Federer. Okay. I think the thing that strikes me about with Federer is that the thing that will be telling is if how good and how healthy Rafa is. if Rafa is back and Federer has to play him a lot, then I don't think he's going to have the year he just had.
He did dodge him a lot last year. Right.
I just don't think that's just a bad matchup, and I think will continue to be a bad matchup. So I think a lot depends to me on how often he has to face Nadal. Other than that, he can beat anybody. He can do anything. I do think I think it'll be difficult for him to repeat next year, repeat this past year, the consistency of it. He won a lot of tournaments.
Won the most matches on tour.
I don't know if that in a year when he's going to turn 34 is realistic. I think to keep his ranking where it was or where he's going to have to win one of the majors, which he hasn't been able to do the last 2 years, and despite having a really good year, he couldn't quite win that big match this year. You know, it was close, but So that will have to change. I just don't see him being. I think it's going to be tough to continue. This was almost like a bounce back year. Everything was great again. He was excited again. You know, how can he keep that up physically and mentally?
Yeah, I mean, for Roger, what I called this year for Roger is actually one of the best years he had, but you have to put it in the context, you know, obviously away from the peak years of 05 to 08 or 07. But, you know, all things considered, especially where he was coming off from 2013, this was, you know, a fantastic year for him. You know, looking ahead to next year for Roger, in the magazine we actually did some things about player of the year, breakthrough, disappointments. I actually said that Roger would be my biggest disappointment, but I think that's another thing that needs to be viewed in context of, I think the expectations now that people see for Federer is that, you know, he was really, as you actually mentioned in your number one match, he was a set away at Wimbledon from finishing the year number one. And I think that if Federer ends up around this 4-6 range, which, you know, for a player of his age, I think, you know, you can't say that anything else, that's still a fantastic year. I think people are going to be a little clouded from what they saw this year. It is tough to see him winning all those matches and doing that again. The one thing that'll be interesting to see with him and Stan is whether they decide to play Davis Cup again and how that impacts their schedules.
Yeah, I sort of doubt that Federer will. You know, I think it would be smart of him not to, for the same reason. I guess it helped him in the past not to play, kept him, you know, healthier. So, you know, we'll see. It's hard to tie. I can't say that I've written Federer off, but I didn't think at this point he would still be almost be number one in the world at this stage. So we'll see how long he can stay at that level.
Yeah, I mean, this is just another chapter in what we're going to be looking back on. It's just an all-time career. It's really impressive stuff here. Number three. So this is where Rafa is right now. If you're looking at points, a distant third from Novak and Roger at 1-2. Still up quite a bit on the rest of the pack. Rafa, you know, obviously whenever we get to him, health will be a huge talking point for him. There's so many tournaments he has missed and could miss and has opportunities to gain because he didn't play in the previous year and get more ranking points. With all that said, who knows where Rafa falls in this list? Who's your number three?
Number three, I had Nishikori. I think he really separated himself from the young guys last year. You know, he still has a size disadvantage with some of these top guys, but he's really, as Federer and Nadal said when they saw him when he was a teenager, he may be the best ball striker of anybody. He's shown that he can challenge any of those guys. I don't know if he has the sort of confidence. He did make a Grand Slam final.
Like intensity, almost, in a way?
Djokovic. He almost doesn't have the cockiness or the sense of entitlement. I wonder about that to become a number one player. I don't know if that's his mindset. He really did get nervous and play poorly and was obviously pretty tired in the U.S. Open final. We'll see if that experience helps him if he gets back to those levels. But I just think his ability, his ball striking, and the way he finished the year, pretty a pretty good finish at the World Tour Finals, making the semis there. I do feel like he's elevated himself. It could have been 1 year, a one and done thing, but you know, I just have to like his game and the way he played the top guys all year.
Yeah, and you know, Nishikori has been, you know, I know that this year was the most of all, but he has over the past few years gotten some big wins against, you know, very, very big players sporadically, and I think we saw, even despite, you know, he still suffered a couple injuries this year, kind of really some poor times. You know, he had to withdraw from Miami semis, he had to retire against Rafa in Madrid, but overall, this was, you know, I think the Nishikori that some who have been following him for a long time were expecting to see here. I just read a thing from Michael Chang, I think his coach. He was very bullish, I think, on Kay heading into next year, too, you know, with a year under their belts together. You know, he said something to the effect of, Nishikori has the opportunity to win at any Grand Slam because of his all-surface ability, because really of his game in general. And, you know, that's another partnership that I think has bore early fruit here. But I think, you know, a little bit like Dimitrov, obviously many steps down from Nishikori at the moment, but, you know, 2014 in general, you know, such a breakthrough year for Nishikori. And, you know, I think a little bit like Simona Halep on the women's side, you know, him finishing in the top five. And I think some people think, you know, like yourself, that they can go much higher.
Yeah, I think Nishikori this year was the first year where you really saw, and you know, and it was definitely because of Chang, this sort of toughness, or this, he instilled a certain, I don't want to say swagger, but a certain sense that for Kay that he belongs there at the top. And that's my question with him. The ability is there, but how does he see himself? I guess that's my question. The top guys always seem to feel like they deserve to be number one. They have to be there or it's a disappointment. Does Kay feel that way about himself?
Yeah. Now, number one and two here, I'm very curious to see who you take here. And, you know, I'm thinking about it for a couple things. First of all, you could, it's either going to be Isner or Djokovic. I understand. No, I'm just kidding.
Right.
But, you know, I'm wondering who you pick here because the way that and you've described this many times, the way that the Rafa-Noel rivalry is gone, it's that whenever we've seen one prolonged stretch of greatness from each man, the other guy seems to find a way to top it. And you can't really, you never really see when it's coming, but it's always there. And I don't know whether you have Rafa won or Novak won, but, you know, I'm thinking back to Rafa when he, you know, 1 year ago at this time at the Australian Open, you know, Rafa just looked just unbelievable, outstanding. Hard court's never been his surface. He's had the mileage on himself, and he went out, and until he ran into, of course, another unfortunate injury there, this was clearly the top player in the game, and he was coming off, you know, of course, one of his best years of his career in 2013. So with all that said, I'm going to give the floor to you here. Who is your number two year-end player?
Number two, I have Djokovic.
Okay.
First, I would say that part of that pick is that picking Djokovic to finish number one again is somewhat a pick against boredom, against just a boring pick that everyone thinks you're going to pick. Djokovic is the percentage guy. He's been number one three of the last 4 years. There's nothing to say that he's coming down at all. I guess I would say that he still has had his bad moments in the big matches. He won Wimbledon, but it was close. I don't know if the Becker partnership has been everything he thought it would be. It hasn't changed his game. He was the best player last year. He had a great season overall on all surfaces, as he always does. The only reason I pick him to finish number two is because of who I picked at number one, which is Nadal. For the reason that you mentioned, I feel like Rafa's a guy who finishes number one and has an amazing year every 2 or 3 years. He finished number one in 2013. He was injured last year. I feel like this is his last. This may be his last run, year-long run. I think he's not old enough, and he's too good not to have another run in him in his career. We've seen it from Federer, obviously. I don't think you can say he's just going to fade away from injury, because he's always come back from it. And it would make sense to me, maybe not at the Australian Open, that may be too soon for him, but as over the course of the year, starting with clay, of course, that he would have another, you know, he would be motivated enough and get on another roll that he could finish another year number one. It's a risky pick because he always finishes the year poorly, and I wouldn't expect him to suddenly dominate all through the year. But I do think he has another. I just think he's too good to not to have another number one run in him. And now that he's taken some time off, presumably all the last year's injuries or problems are over, I think that leaves him clear. I think he likes
the chase,
coming from behind, not having the points, getting on a roll. He's never defended a number one ranking the way Djokovic has and Federer has. You know, Rafa's the guy who he's the guy he's the guy who chases the other guys down. And I think he has that opportunity again. So in a way, it's a pick for interest's sake, and also because I do think
I don't have a problem with that. I think it's well reasoned. As you say about the chase too, it should be said he's still only three away from Federer from the Grand Slam title count. He goes out of his way to say that that is not a goal, but that's that has to of course enter in at some point there. Yeah. I think the schedule really has always kind of not necessarily after the U.S. Open, but the way that the tour is laid out and the clay schedule, I think, always works in Rafa's favor to some degree. He can really build a lot of momentum. Even starting, in Indian Wells and Miami, he's done exceptionally well at those events too, leading into obviously the bread and butter of his season. In 2015, there's actually going to be another week in between the French and Wimbledon. I think that is that's a big, big help to Rafa over anybody on this list. And there, like I said, I think for a lot of those reasons, they're bullish on for Rafa. And if we may delve back into coaching one last time, this is becoming a big theme of this, but we're talking about players who have different coaches, have brought in new coaches throughout their careers. Rafa is the exception to that rule. He has had one ear in his corner the whole time. It is Tony Nadal, who you wrote earlier this year, put the question forth, is Tony Nadal the greatest coach of all time? And I think, for all we can say about Rafa and, what we think of where he's going from here, that is a constant that you never really have to worry about, is he is going to, the expectations are set extremely high in his camp, and I don't think you ever have to worry about him not giving every inch that he can. When he plays, when he doesn't play, he can't play. But when he plays, I think you can expect, from the start, you don't have to temper your expectations with him.
Yeah, I think, you mentioned that Nadal likes to say that he doesn't really have Federer's record in mind, but Tony Nadal does.
Yes.
At last year's Australian Open, he brought up the fact that nobody had ever won in the Open era all the Grand Slams twice, except for Rod Laver, and that if Rafa won the Australian Open, he would become the next person to do that. So Tony Nadal obviously has these things in mind, and he likes to prod Rafa with them, and I don't think that's going to change. And, Nadal's, he's not 30 years old. Federer's 33. Look where he is. Rafa's had all kinds of problems, but he's always bounced back for them. So we'll see. I think it will be good to have him in the mix. Hopefully for an entire season.
I'll end this a little on Djokovic because he is the number one, and we talked, I think, a little more about Rafa than him here. But I think that 2015 for Djokovic in particular, I think overall there is, perhaps more uncertainty than at least we've seen in recent years with this top men's group, that I think Djokovic has a really, really big opportunity in front of him. This is sort of, to me, perhaps like a legacy year where if he really does get on a roll and is in that 2011 type of playing mentality and mindset, and he's not that far removed from it. I would certainly say that Djokovic is still in his prime, no doubt about that. I think we're seeing, you know, this 4 or 5 year stretch of him, you know, able to do great things in this game. And I think, you know, really the sky is the limit for him this year. And, you know, there's the French, of course, that he's going to be targeting once again. I think he'll perhaps play that down a little bit more as compared to previous years where he was, you know, really focusing on it tunnel vision wise. But, you know, this guy, he has the game where, you know, nothing is off the table for him. And I think most curious of all of 2015 is how well Novak Djokovic does and really where he puts himself on the pecking order of the all-time greats, because he's passed some incredible players with his accomplishments thus far, and he's not that far away from some others.
Yeah, it's hard to know what to think of him going into this next year. Last year, he came off a 24-match winning streak, and you would have thought he's going to roll through the Australian Open. He'd won it the 3 years before, but then he loses in the quarters for the first time at a slam in more than 10 Grand Slams. So he's, you know, for the last year, he's sort of confounded expectations, or at least my expectations. He played a bad French Open final, then bounced back and won Wimbledon, and then had a very strange U.S. hard court season where he was seen pretty much out of it through the whole thing, which was, to me, was unexpected. And then he had a good end of the year World Tour final. He won it. But so it sort of leaves me thinking that I think the only thing you can think is he's going to put himself in contention all the time on every surface, and, you know, we'll see which ones go his way and which ones don't. I don't think they're all, you know, evidence would say that they're not all going to go his way, but he'll be there.
I will actually, and now that I look at one more thing, let's last thing before we go, you know, the most recent Grand Slam champion, Marin Cilic, where do you see him going in 2015? Because I think, you know, I think he will divide some opinion as well about if that was really one of those lightning in a bottle moments, and really the body of work from him taken from his whole career suggests that this is not a guy who we can expect to see at the quarterfinals or better of slams, you know, as a given and a top five type player. You know, where do you see Cilic going from here, you know, after such an obviously outstanding U.S. Open?
Yeah, I thought about Cilic in the top 10, and it's definitely possible. I didn't like the way he ended the year. He seemed to go back, not just because, you know, he didn't win anything at the World Tour final against the top players, and that wasn't good in a sense. That's his new peer group. That's his new competition that you're going to want him to see what he does against, how he does against, and he didn't do very well. But I also felt like he didn't show any of the sort of Superman, the power that he had suddenly had at the U.S. Open. He was back to sort of the way he usually plays, which would indicate to me that it's a little like Wawrinka. Cilic is a similar situation. He's a guy who hadn't won many tournaments before last year's U.S. Open, had never won a big tournament, never won a Masters, never even won a 500, sort of like Wawrinka. Suddenly then he wins a Grand Slam. I see Cilic, and it sort of seems to me that he'll go back to where he was, better, with the knowledge that he can beat anybody, but that I don't know if I see him quite making the top 10, maybe being just outside, because that, you know, his game is never, other than that 2 weeks or even 1 week, mm-hmm. I really haven't seen that his game ever be like that before or after.
It really was, you know, that's a good point, the 1 week. It really was just a switch was flipped, and it was over from that point. Yeah. Good. This is fantastic here. So we'll have to check on, we'll, a year from now, we will, of course, check our work here, see what happened.
Yeah, we'll forget all about it.
Yeah, this podcast will be in the ether somewhere. But for now, it was a good time to make our list and check it twice, of course. So we have, of course, if I didn't mention, the women's podcast with myself and Nina Pantic, that's up as well on the site on iTunes. Check that out. And we'll be doing, you know, quite a few more podcasts here as the, obviously as January approaches, we'll be, season's pretty much here already, if you can believe it or not. So thank you to Steve for coming on and giving us your thoughts. This is the Tennis.com Podcast. I'm Ed McGrogan for Steve Tegner.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com Podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.